You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, December 7th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Naheed Siamdoust, assistant professor of Middle East and Media Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Also on the program today, Eli Friedman, professor of Cornell University School of Industrial and Labor Relations, author of The China Question, Toward Left Perspectives, edited with Kevin Lin and Ashley Smith. Also on the program today, Raphael Warnock wins. Democrats gain a Senate seat in the midterms and more control over the Senate. Trump Inc. found guilty in Manhattan of tax fraud. And that's that. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court hears Harper v. Moore today. That's the case that pushes the independent legislator theory we talked about yesterday on the program. 1,100 people, workers, are planning a walkout at the New York Times for tomorrow, unless they can come to a deal. Germany arrests dozens in an apparent right-wing coup plot. Hertz is ordered to pay $168 million for falsely accusing customers of stealing their cars. Juul settles 5,000 vaping suits in California. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Oh, you know what else I forgot was that the National Defense Authorization Act compromise has been reached. And good news, folks, the Pentagon budget will grow $45 billion, $820 billion if they're in a position to pass this. So
I feel more secure already.
Safer. Feeling safer. Breathe deep. And of course, joining me today on this very special day.
It is hump day.
That's right. Emma Vigeland, who coined that phrase, how many years ago was it now? Almost 3 years ago. Two or three years ago?
At this point, well, I mean, yeah, 2 years ago.
That's great.
To the day.
folks, I should also say this. I just got this IM to remind me. The Twitch streamer Vouch is doing a 24-hour live stream raising funds for the PV22 canvassing group, which knocked over on over 9,000 doors in Georgia.
People doing actual politics down there.
Yep. So after this program, head over there. We'll remind you. Can we raid his stream?
Yeah, we can raid Vouch.
Yeah, okay, we'll do
then
that.
We'll do that. All right, let's get to this. We've got a lot to talk about today. Here is Raphael Warnock speaking to supporters, and there are material implications to getting 51 as opposed to 50 in the Senate. You're not at 52, so you can't eliminate the relevance of Manchin and Sinema, but the power-sharing agreement that Chuck Schumer had to make with Mitch McConnell at the beginning of the Senate 2 years ago has changed, or will change. No longer is it 50-50 on committees, which now means that Schumer will have the power to move even more judges through the Judiciary Committee and more legislation, although that's not going to pass. But the big issue, and there's subpoena power in the Senate now, too, that is much easier in the event that there's investigations that the Senate wants to do. But the real issue is that Joe Biden was able to appoint as many lifetime appointments to the judiciary at the same pace as Donald Trump in the first half of his administration. And that pace is going to be able to be picked up now. So this is a big deal in terms of the federal judiciary. I would also, you know, obviously in the event that there needs to be a Supreme Court pick, there is, you know, a little more wiggle room.
There's a cushion. And there's also electoral implications for the Democrats in 2024 because the map is less favorable for them. Two-thirds of Democratic Senate seats will be up for re-election, including some, like, scary ones like Sherrod Brown, the other Nevada senator, Jackie, what's her last name again?
Rosen,
and then Manchin and Sinema both up in 2024. So it just makes it a little less scary for them.
A little less. But here is Raphael Warnock at the beginning of his now full-on six-year term.
I am a proud son of Savannah, Georgia. Coastal city known for its verdant town squares and its cobblestone streets. Tall, majestic oak trees dripping with Spanish moss bend and beckon the love of history and horticulture to this city by the sea. My roots, like the roots of those oak trees, go deep down into the soil of Savannah and Waycross and Scriven County and Burke County. I am Georgia. I am an example and an iteration of its history, of its pain and its promise, of the brutality and the possibility. But because this is America, and because we always have a path to make our country greater against unspeakable odds, here we stand together. Thank you, Georgia.
So there it is, Raphael Warnock. Savannah was a particularly brutal city in terms of like the slave trade. It wasn't just auctions there. It was literally like, almost like a mall for slaves, where you would go and just buy them.
Yep. Areas.
And, a lot of brutality in that city. And, Raphael Warnock wins. We also have to acknowledge that he won because Herschel Walker was his opponent. And, you know, that's a pretty close race. It ends up being about 51-49%. And that is, when you think about Herschel Walker as the candidate, it's hard to imagine that if they hadn't gotten a stronger candidate, there might have been much tougher road to hoe. But, you know,
Republicans still have to do primaries.
Well, exactly. And the other thing is, you know, we're looking 6 years out now.
Yeah.
And there's a good chance that Georgia is going to be a different Georgia in 6 years than it is today. I mean, that's a, you know, particularly we'll look at the breakdown of youth vote in Georgia. But I imagine when those folks are 6 years older and the people who are, you know, anywhere from 12 years old and older are going to be voting at that time. It's going to be a very different Georgia. So, and it's going to make a big difference in terms of getting judges in. And that is really important after the 4 years that we had with Donald Trump. We're going to take a break in just a moment. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about Iran and then we'll be talking about China. Both have been seeing protests, obviously different implications for both those countries. But first, a couple of words from our sponsors. Got a good idea for a holiday gift for you that's going to be appreciated every night. Cozy Earth. It is the brand that made Oprah's favorite thing 5 years in a row. So we've talked about Cozy Earth bedding.
I have the duvet.
And I found my new sheets that allow me not to get overheated because they are made from I guess what's called viscose. It just seems like fabric to me, but highly sustainable bamboo.
Yeah.
And apparently it is naturally temperature regulating. They are comfy all around. But I recently broke down because we were talking about it last time. And guess what I bought?
The comforter?
No.
Oh, loungewear.
Yes. I got the joggers.
That is like...
They're like sweatpants.
Yeah.
Over the weekend, I found myself, I'm wearing these to go get coffee. And then I'm wearing these. And then by the end of the day, I realized like I hadn't taken them off all day. They're incredibly soft. They also have t-shirts. They have pajamas. And the joggers are just like, they're like sweatpants. Like,
no, I know.
I mean, sweatpants. I had no idea what those even meant. But they're...
Welcome to the world of being comfortable in your clothes. Like, you don't have to wear jeans all the time.
Yeah. No, I don't wear jeans anyways.
Okay. Or pants, whatever.
I do wear pants.
I apologize.
You can also check out their new premium plush and waffle bath towels. You and your loved ones are going to adore those, too. Every Cozy Earth bedding item comes in a beautiful, reusable canvas bag. No gift wrapping required. That's also true. And so doesn't the loungewear.
Mm.
Or at least my jogger did. I gotta say, I think I'm now like full in on the loungewear thing. I'm gonna go for a shirt next. You can save 40% now on Cozy Earth. Hurry, holiday offer ends soon. Go to cozyearth.com/majority. Be sure to enter majority at checkout. Save 40%. That's cozyearth.com/majority. All backed by a 100-night sleep guarantee. cozyearth.com/majority. Also, sponsoring the program today, Nutrafol. You don't have to choose between better hair growth and your health. There's a holistic solution for men, and it works for women too. You knew somebody who took this that gives both healthier hair and whole body wellness. Get ahead of thinning hair with Nutrafol's whole body approach to hair growth. No drugs, no compromises. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement. It's clinically shown to improve your hair growth, thickness, and visible scalp coverage. Nutrafol's hair growth nutraceuticals go beyond genetics to multi-target the root causes of thinning, including stress, hormones, nutrition, metabolism, aging, and lifestyle through whole body health. It's physician formulated using natural medical grade ingredients. Nutrafol is drug free. It has a patented technology that provides consistent, reliable results without compromising your sexual health. So in a clinical study, men showed progressive improvement in hair growth and thickness after 3 and 6 months. It means you don't have to put, these drugs in your body, all supplement based. It's no wonder that Nutrafol is trusted and recommended by more than 3,000 top doctors. So what are you waiting for? You can grow thicker, healthier hair, and you can support the show by going to Nutrafol.com, entering the promo code TMR for the Majority Report, just TMR, to save $15 off your first month's subscription. This is their best offer anywhere. It's available only to U.S. customers. Sorry, other folks. And it's only for a limited time. Plus, you get free shipping on every order. Get $15 off at Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code TMR. And lastly, I used this weekend too. I went to a party, first party in a long time, and Z-Biotics before I went out.
I'm jealous.
Yep. One of our sponsors is Z-Biotics, giving you 15% off with the code MAJORITY. You got holiday parties right around the corner. You want to be feeling your best the next day. Or maybe you're just going over, seeing some friends, having a couple of drinks. Z-Biotics is a probiotic drink that breaks down the byproduct of alcohol, which it turns out is the most responsible for rough mornings after drinking. Dehydration, part of it, but this is the most important thing. If you drink a bottle of Z-Biotics before your first drink of alcohol, one bottle is all you need. Doesn't matter, again, if you're going to have one drink or you're going to have multiple ones. You drink responsibly. You pace yourself. You get a good night's sleep. Next day you wake up, you feel normal. You feel refreshed.
Bingo bango.
Bingo bango. You don't have to worry about it. You want to work out? You work out. You want to go in and do work? You do work. You want to go do a podcast? You do a podcast. Again, it's apparently a toxic byproduct of alcohol that builds up in your unprepared gut that makes you feel terrible the next day after drinking. And Z-Biotics produces an enzyme, sort of like the one that your liver uses, breaks down this byproduct, and it is the first genetically engineered probiotic. It's created by altering the DNA of a natural probiotic bacteria that we eat all the time. Z-Biotics is not vitamins, not plant extracts, no off-the-shelf ingredients. Z-Biotics is rigorously tested and FDA compliant for safety. So if you're the kind of person who enjoys drinks with friends, or you want to go out and go to a party, or you unwind at the end of the day and you got a full day the next day, you don't want to be feeling terrible, Z-Biotics is perfect for you. Now, we haven't talked about this, but next week I am going on the Nation cruise.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been told that when you drink on a boat, well, I'll talk about this later, the whole thing, well, in the fun half, but when you go on a boat, that it is especially rough. So I'm bringing a 6 days worth supply. But you can get your first 15% off order at Z-Biotics pre-alcohol probiotic. Go to zbiotics.com/majority. Use the code majority. That's the letter Z and then the word biotics, biotics.com/majority. Coupon code majority at checkout saves you 15%. As always, we will put the links to all of these in our YouTube and podcast descriptions. Going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Nahid Sam Doost. She is an assistant professor of Middle East and Media Studies at the University of Texas at Austin about the protests that have roiled Iran. And we are supposedly on day two of a 3-day strike in Iran. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Nahid C.M. Doost. She is Assistant Professor of Middle East and Media Studies at the University of Texas in Austin. Nahid, we are supposedly, my understanding is, on day two of a 3-day strike. Tell us what you know about that, and then we will go back to sort of the origins of what we're seeing in Iran and assess what it could mean for the future.
Sure. So today is 16 Azar, which is the National Day of Students in Iran. It's a historic day when students rose up against Nixon's visit, actually, during the Shah era. And because students were killed at the time, it has become this historical Students' Day. And it's actually day three today. And what we saw today across the country, as we have over the last 2 days, is students gathering in universities all over Iran and chanting slogans, and also people gathering in Tehran Azadi Square, the Freedom Square, to chant slogans for the Woman Life Freedom Movement.
It's fascinating to me that this is a holiday that started where there was protests against the Shah, who, of course, was deposed by, I guess, the beginning of, I mean, the Ayatollah Khomeini. And this is the extension of that regime. And these are two sort of disparate regimes, but yet the sort of, I guess, the essence of this holiday remains.
That's right. I think what we have to understand about this freedom movement is that it's really the continuation of a century-long freedom movement in Iran, which started with the Constitutional Revolution in 1906, when Iranians gathered to call for the disbanding of the monarchy then and for a constitutional monarchy. They succeeded in doing that. And in fact, this movement is very much sort of, you know, compared to that one because of its leaderless nature. And then, you know, throughout the years, they didn't achieve their republic. Another monarchy took the place of another one, the Pahlavi instead of the Qajar. And then, of course, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi became, you know, the sort of pillar of American imperialism in the Middle East. And so the student protests against the Nixon visit in Iran established the students as this center of protest and the center for upholding this freedom movement. And they really have retained that that sort of, you know, that position in Iranian history. So from the 1950s onward to today, throughout post-revolution Iran against the Shah in the 1970s, they were a main reason for why, you know, from both abroad, the sort of exiled expatriate students in the U.S. and elsewhere and students within Iran were at the forefront of bringing about the protests against the government, both in pre-revolutionary Iran and since the 1979 revolution.
There's a little of a tangent, but why is that? I mean, because I'm thinking in terms of, like, you know, protest movements around the globe, and it's, I don't feel like it's they're that consistently located in one cohort, and particularly when you would imagine, like, this is not, you know, this people go to school for a limited period of time, and then they're out of school. Like, what is it about the is it the university system? Is it something cultural in terms of, like, the age? Why is protest so consistently centered in among students?
So as much as students are at the forefront, I just want to point out that, you know, this has been a very widespread protest, which has brought in vast segments of society, whether it's, you know, the women have been also on the front lines, the workers, teachers. All segments of ordinary people, all segments of society have been part of this protest movement and have been traditionally too. But students have been really leading it because they are Iran's youngest and brightest. Iran's university system is famously very good, both pre-revolution and post-revolution. Iran has one of the biggest brain drains in the world, many of them leaving to the U.S. to join some of the best universities here, whether it's Stanford or MIT. And so these are Iran's youngest and brightest. And more recently, you know, during the reformist movement in the 90s, and again now recently, students, when they rise up, Iranians really give them their backing because they know that if it is their youngest and brightest standing up for freedom, for justice against, you know, complete impunity by the government, they are willing to back that. And so they've sort of taken on this mantle of a sort of, you know, wisdom, if you will, that is trustworthy and worth backing.
My understanding, too, is that outside of just students, some of these protests are sparking in Kurdish regions in the country as well. What's the significance of that in addition to the whole student element?
Yeah, Emma, that's an important aspect to mention because, of course, the woman who was killed, Mahsa Jina Amini, the 22-year-old whose death really sparked this revolutionary uprising, she was Kurdish. And so the first, although the first protest really was right in front of the hospital where her death was reported, but ignited the day after at her funeral in Sakhiz, a city in Kurdistan. And so other people across Iran and Tehran and other major cities rose up instantly in solidarity, you know, with the protests against her death in Kurdistan. And so what's special about that is that this is the first time where we see different ethnic minorities, different segments all across Iran really expressing solidarity with each other. So far, we've had several protest movements in post-revolutionary Iran, right? We've had the student uprising in 1999. We had the Green Uprising in 2009, which was really an uprising for reforms. And we've had strikers by workers and so on. But this is the first time where we see in the slogans themselves, protesters in Tehran expressing solidarity with protesters in Kurdistan and in Balochistan, protesters in the north at the Caspian, the Gilakis, expressing solidarity with the Azeris, the Turks. Iran is a big ethnic patchwork, right? This notion of Iran being a land of the Persians is a myth. And Iranians themselves know that. And they're very proud of this very diverse nation that they have. And so the significance of that is that, you know, despite sort of the government's attempts to sometimes draw, you know, characterize protests in certain, you know, minorities and ethnic regions as being sort of separatist movements, Iranians now within those regions themselves have expressed solidarity with others across the country and expressed their allegiance with, you know, the Iranian nation and their Iranian identity. So the reason this is important that we have all these different groupings come together and express the same goal, which is a change to the political system.
I want to get to that last part as to what the what kind of change they're looking for. What was the context in which Amini's death would spark this type of uprising? And B, that it we're seeing this type of ethnic solidarity that may have not been there as obvious in the past.
Right. So it may have been there. It just hadn't really sort of percolated so visibly to the surface, in part because, you know, the minorities hadn't really dared. They hadn't really had the courage to rise up to the way they have this time around. And this is because, you know, the worst repression has happened within those minority regions, whether it's the Arabs in Khuzestan in the southwest of Iran, the Kurds in the northwest, the Azeris in the northwest, the Baluch in the southeast, the Lors even in the central plateau. So because of the more extreme repression that has been imposed on the minorities, they haven't really had the courage to rise up to the extent that they have. But it was a sort of, you know, feeding loop effect where they rose up in Kurdistan and instantly people rose up all across the country in solidarity. And that really gave them a support and spirit to continue their protests. And also in Balochistan, where every Friday people have gathered after Friday prayers to express protests. And, you know, a large number of the people who have been killed by the regime in this very revolutionary uprising over the last 12 weeks have been Kurds and Baluchis. And so we have to hold on to that fact. But I think it really has been a sort of national consensus that the current regime holds so much impunity. There's so much corruption. The politics of grief and death, people are sick and tired of it. And so this national solidarity around that has encouraged and energized everybody to rise up and express solidarity with each other.
Has the regime been actively doing has the regime had an active strategy to maintain some type of ethnic rivalry or no?
Not as such, really. I mean, because, again, it wouldn't really have too much hold within, you know, Iranian cultural national mentality, because many families are diverse. They have their intermarriages between, you know, Kurds and, let's say, Persian speakers or Kurds and Azeris. And so it's not the kind of situation like Iraq, let's say, where sectarianism really has been, you know, a successful sort of strategy for some politicians.
I wanted to ask you a bit about the origins of the Morality Police, the group that was responsible for the death of Mahsa Amini. To me, from the outside, it seems like a glorified, like, street gang that now has legitimacy and has gotten so over a period of time. Can you give us a rundown of that process and I guess how the Iranian Revolution sparked their existence and where they're at today?
Yeah, so the Morality Police initially used to just be called the committees. And this started a few years into the revolution. In 1983, Iran's hijab law was actually systematized and formalized legally so that all Iranian women in public after the age of puberty had to cover up. And so with that, you had these vans and cars going around the cities and admonishing or apprehending women who, in their opinion, weren't covered up enough. In 2005, the Ahmadinejad government actually formalized this and put the morality police force under the auspices of the police. And so it became much more sort of regulated. It was supposed to go against the sort of haphazard, you know, events that would take place with the committees roaming the streets, which, as you said, were sort of, you know, glorified vigilantes. And so this formalization was supposed to be actually a kind of reform. However, with the election of Ebrahim Raisi, you know, and then you would see sort of ebbs and flows of that, right? Sort of, do you remember when a more conservative president like Ahmadinejad would take office, he would, you know, promise that women would be apprehended and greater morality would be brought to the streets. And especially over the course of the sort of summer, women would be arrested and harassed more. With Ebrahim Raisi, who's the most conservative president that Iran has had in post-revolutionary Iran, he was the, you know, a protector of the shrine, of the holiest shrine in the country, the head of the judiciary, so very sort of conservative pedigree. As soon as he took office, he said, I am going to bring morality back to the streets, not least because, Iman Sam, over the last 3-4 years, Iranian women have actually pushed back against the hijab. So we've seen this, you know, what sociologists called, as the Fayyad calls, non-movement. So through not really political organizing, but everyday practices, they had already loosened the hijab laws in the public spaces. So they'd already sort of, you know, let the headscarf roll to their shoulders, not bothering to put it back right away. So across the city, Iranians had seen a pushback against the hijab that was, you know, unprecedented, even though they'd done it over the last 2-3 decades. But the visuals of this was really unprecedented, to the extent that one would see many women without headscarves. And so he said, I'm going to bring the morality back to the streets. And so the morality police became much harsher against women. And so we reached the point where Mahsa Amini, somebody who was comparatively actually well-dressed, and this was part of the discourse, right? When you see the CCTV footage of her from within the holding ground where she was held by the morality police, she's wearing a long black robe, she's wearing a headscarf, her hair is pretty well covered. That is pretty impeccable hijab compared to some of the women you will see in Tehran streets who are bare, who are not even wearing actually a coat, and whose headscarf is more like a bandana. And so that, I think, really enraged people because they could identify with Mahsa Amini as somebody who could be anyone's wife, sister, mother. She was very, very sort of, you know, an everyday kind of woman that everybody could identify with, and hence the protests.
And how did that, like, and you talked about, like, you know, this is a movement for broader political change. And there's been some discussion as to whether, you know, is this an uprising, a response, you know, that is sort of like limited to that cultural norm or, you know, I guess police brutality, or is this a revolution that is looking to wholesale sort of change, the structure of society? Give us your sense of what's going on there, and what the political agenda is.
So I think the best way to call this is a revolutionary uprising. And I think the aim of it, not because of what I think, but because of the slogans that we see on the streets and the chants and the demands of the demonstrators and protests that we see on the street, is it's not just about the hijab. They are calling for the downfall of the regime. They're not asking for concessions. They're not asking for reforms. They are simply saying enough with this. And, you know, when we see the art and the culture production that's part of it, you know, we see how textured and nuanced this movement is and how it's ultimately a movement and a revolution for life, right? For a better future, going against the kinds of repression that has been imposed on women's and everybody's bodies, the kinds of regulatory biopolitics of the Islamic Republic that have meant that people cannot aspire to live the kinds of lives that they imagine. And so it's a very imaginative and creative movement as well. But for sure, it's, you know, this is not a movement just to bring down the morality police or to you know, change the laws over hijab. This is a movement for wholesale change. And if you look at the photos and videos coming out of Iran over the last 3 days, although we have to stress that internet is so severely restricted by the government that what we see is a very small percentage of what people are able to send out. You know, you see masses of people all across Iran chanting those very slogans for the downfall of the regime.
So they're looking, are they looking for a more secular regime? Are they looking for any type of, like, economic structural changes, or is it more they're looking for something that's more democratic? Where does it fall on or is it across all three of those silos?
I think it's across all those three. Iranians have now lived through decades where religion, Islam, has been imposed by the running government officially. And, there have been many conversations, and especially on social media, this discourse is rampant among social media users, where they just believe that the Islamic Republic has corrupted Islam by imposing it in a public way and by relying on it for its political capital. And that has both corrupted Islam and it has corrupted the politics. So they're looking for sure if we live to see another sort of day for Iran beyond the Islamic Republic, that government for sure will be a secular and democratic one if things go well.
I guess lastly, do you have a sense of like what happens next? I mean, the momentum for this has at least maintained, I think, longer than maybe many people would have guessed a couple of months ago. Is there a cohort of society that you have yet to see respond, that must respond before there is any type of like revolutionary change?
Yes, I think, we really see civil disobedience across the board. We see, expressions of solidarity across the board. What we haven't seen yet, which, somebody like Erica Chenoweth at Harvard, for example, argues is necessary for the success of revolutionary uprisings or for revolution to succeed, is internally for at least the security forces and the military forces to start giving up their posts and to, sort of join the movement. It's not clear that they haven't. There have been some reports that, the kind of forces that we see on the streets more recently are bodied with super young security officers and also older one, which kind of points to the fact that maybe they're going to their reserves. So we're not exactly sure, but it certainly isn't clear yet that they have, in a significant way joined the protests. And so that's what Iranians are looking to. And they're calling for that in their chants too. They're saying, join us. This is, you no longer can be bystanders. You are on the wrong side of history.
There were reports that the prosecutors have pulled back from the morality police, and it's unclear as to, are they disbanding them, or are they basically just saying, take a break? Is that potentially indicative of maybe trying to let a little air out of the tires so that there is not, so that they don't lose the support of the broader sort of, internal national security state?
Right. So this came up recently and, it was widely reported across Western media that Iran has disbanded the morality police, which is a big deal, of course. But there was actually a lot of confusion around that. This was not an intentional statement by the Iranian government. It happened sort of in the middle of a press conference where a reporter asked, since the protests have started, we haven't really seen the morality police on the streets. So what's happening? Have they disbanded? And so his response was the same place that established them has disbanded them. However, soon after that, both that official and others have said, no, we're still going to go about and police the streets. I think what we have to hold on to, Sam, is that, no matter sort of, they're clearly trying to figure it out, right? They're trying to figure out to what extent and how are we going to enforce more, morality on the streets, because this has led to a big backlash. But I think what we have to hold on to is that for the very first time in its history, the Islamic Republic has publicly stated and admitted that it's trying to figure out what to do about the morality police. And a high official, the prosecutor general, has even said it's been disbanded. And this is due to protesters over the last 12 weeks risking and losing their lives on the street. I think that's sort of the point that we should hold on to, which is they have achieved something, if not nothing else than a confusion by the state trying to figure out what to do.
Naheed Siam Dost, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Eli Friedman. He is a professor at Cornell University School of Industrial and Labor Relations, author of The China Question. And we will be talking to him about our questions about China right after this. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Eli Friedman. He's a professor at Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations, author of The China Question, Toward Left Perspectives, edited with Kevin Lin and Ashley Smith. Eli, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Will you we're seeing protests in China. It's unclear, I guess, at least to me, like how widespread. But will you give us just, I guess, maybe like a 10,000 foot view of contextualizing these protests relative to ones that we've seen, you know, like, for instance, in 1989? Where does this fit in that regard?
Sure. So there's a lot of comparisons happening between what's happening now and in 1989. The scale is almost certainly not on the same level as it was in 89, when you had hundreds of thousands of people in Tiananmen Square. You also had big protests that were happening in other parts of China in 1989. And so the mobilizations have been smaller in scale. They've been more fractured, maybe in more cities this time than was the case in 89. They also have already more or less died down just in the past week, and that's due in part to repression, but also some important concessions that we can talk about. And so, you know, there's a debate about how many people are actually on the street, which is maybe not the most significant thing, but they're clearly not on the same scale. I think it's also worth mentioning, sometimes people have this misconception that China's an authoritarian country and therefore people never protest. And that's actually not true. So after 1989, you don't have the same big scale, very politicized kind of protest, but you do have quite a lot of small scale, localized protests, labor protests, peasants whose land has been taken, you know, things over environmental issues. So there actually has been a fair amount of unrest. It just hasn't been coordinated and organized at kind of the national level in the way that we've been seeing in late November.
So outside of scale, I mean, qualitatively, like what was 1989 about relative to what we see now? And then I also want to go back and ask a question about the about that nature of localized protest and what happens. But qualitatively speaking, 1989, it's not what we're seeing now is not of the scale. But what was the impetus then versus the impetus now from your perspective?
Sure. So the big demand in 1989 that was oftentimes not super clearly articulated was democracy. And you know, there's these interviews, they go out, they talk to the students and they talk to the workers, a part of the protest that oftentimes is overlooked. And they didn't necessarily have a very clearly articulated vision for what a democratic China would look like, but they understood that there was something that they were dissatisfied with the existing political system and that there was that they wanted things to move in a more democratic direction, right? And so in that sense, it was a pretty direct challenge to one party rule. These protests.
Can I ask you, and we should say, just for folks who are not as old as me, but that was part of a, I mean, this is the time, we were just around the time, the fall of the Berlin Wall. I mean, so this is in the air, in terms of these expectations of democracy. And I guess it's also the sort of the notion of like the possibility of the introduction of democracy.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the protests in China took place in April, May, and then the crackdown was in early June. So it actually preceded the fall of the Berlin Wall by several months. But, you know, there was a key moment in 1989 when Gorbachev was actually in town. And you know, he was a reformist. He didn't want to see the collapse of the Soviet Union, which is eventually what happened, right? But clearly there were big critiques that were being leveled against against one party communist rule in Eastern Europe. So it definitely was part of that bigger movement. Of course, there was very different outcomes in Eastern Europe and Russia than there was in China.
I feel like there was also like a big a concert like Bowie played sometime around there too that had started the talk of this in the late 80s. There was a couple of rock concerts that seemed to sort of like kick off that move. Maybe that's just my imagination. But
Gorbachev going to like Taco Bell and stuff like that as well, right? That was around that time.
It was certainly in the air. It feels like. But please continue. Sorry.
Well, I don't actually know about the Bowie. I'm pretty certain that the first foreign band that was allowed to play in China in the 80s was Wham, George Michael. So I don't know. I don't know what George Michael was talking about, but
well, he was a revolutionary force in many respects.
you know, it was. I do think that one of the big differences in terms of thinking about 89 versus the present moment is that there's the sense of critiquing of authoritarianism, of one party rule. If you look at the present moment, actually, most countries are becoming less democratic. Right now, they have different baselines, and so China has never been very democratic, and it has become more authoritarian, more repressive. But just about every other country in the world is also, you know, facing severe challenges to democracy. And so there isn't that same kind of international zeitgeist that might have existed in 89.
And so this feels like it has been both in its genesis and in the way that we've seen it recede, a function of like the COVID policy that China was pursuing. Give us a sense of it started at the was it started at the Foxconn plant or give us a sense of how this sort of like spread and what it says about what level of risk was associated with this? I mean, because you say that there've been, you know, there's also plenty of local protests. Like, what level of risk is assumed in a protest like that?
So there's different ways of telling the recent history of these protests. I think we should trace it back to the Shanghai lockdown of April 2022. And that was a time when I think people really began dissenting with the zero COVID policy in a way that was very, very different than if we go back to the Wuhan lockdown of 2020, when there was just a lot of social support, a lot of buy-in for those extreme measures. By 2022 in Shanghai, things are very different. Like, the rest of the world has moved on and the virus has mutated. It's much harder to control and it's basically endemic everywhere else in the world. And so people are kind of fed up with it. And you saw actually much more individualized kinds of resistance and griping happening in Shanghai and in all of the big cities over the summer and into the fall, where there were periodic lockdowns. The kind of immediate chain of events that led up to the big protests were first the things that happened at Foxconn, the Zhengzhou Foxconn facility that produces about 3/4 of the world's iPhones. And there was a big worker uprising there because they were keeping workers in the so-called closed loop system, where they go into the factory and they're not allowed to leave. They were being exposed to the virus. They weren't getting adequate food or medical attention. And so there was this huge uprising. Then there was a fire in Urumqi, which is the capital of Xinjiang in northwestern China. There was at least 10 people who died in this fire, all or most of whom were Uyghurs, which I think is significant against the backdrop of the repression and the internment camps that Muslim minorities have been subjected to. And this really resonated with people because there was this feeling that these people might not have died had it not been for the lockdown. In some cases, people have been actually just locked, chained in their apartments, right? And so the fire risk is very real. And so the thing that then set off nationwide protests was a response to the fire that killed people in Urumqi, and they were framed as vigils, right? And so framing something as a vigil rather than a protest against the central government is, you know, it's a little bit softer, a little bit more space for tolerance. But then to come to the final question about how much risk is implied, well, it's ambiguous, right? According to the Chinese constitution, you know, Chinese people have the right to freedom of association, freedom of speech. Everybody understands that those things are not actually realized. But when some of those protests targeted not just the kind of the local implementation of the zero policy, which is relatively safe, although not perfectly safe, And they began targeting the national policy. Most famously in the protests that happened in Shanghai, people were chanting, down with Xi Jinping, down with the Communist Party, right? So when you're at a protest where that those kinds of chants are happening, then the risk is really increased significantly.
So it's one thing to say, like, our local councilman is doing this wrong, as opposed to the people who are really in charge of that first order, you know, they're illegitimate, I guess, is where you start to cross the line.
What, that's right.
Well, and I want to get to the Uyghurs in a moment too, but what was the theory behind the zero COVID policy? I mean, I certainly understand it in the context of 2020 and in the context of early 2021. I mean, but at one point when the rest of the world does start to sort of open up more, and I happen to believe that maybe in many respects we've done it more aggressively than I think is probably ultimately we're going to find is has been healthy for us. But you don't have that. There's more pressure on the Chinese government. You don't have that sense of like, we don't want to be the one country that is, you know, we're all sort of in the same boat now. And it's sort of there seems to be this sort of like international sort of acceptance of like, yeah, you know what, we're now okay with three times the amount of people dying from, you know, the as opposed to the flu, and we're all in the same boat where we're going to have a weakened immunity system maybe, and long COVID's going to be a feature of humanity, and we've just, you know, accepted it. Like, how, what was the theory? Is it that, I mean, you know, because we're talking about a well over a billion people. And so when you start to get into like tiny percentages, we're talking a lot of people. Were they worried about hospitals? What was their, I guess maybe just, you know, and analogize it for folks. We're worried about flattening the curve because we thought our hospitals could get overwhelmed at one point. What was their primary concern?
Yeah. So there are some good reasons for pursuing zero COVID and there are some not so good reasons. So let me do the not so good reasons first. If you look back to 2020, they had the very intense lockdown in Wuhan, and they crushed the virus, right? At the same time, the virus is beginning to spread around the world, and you know we're all familiar with what happened in the United States and Western Europe and other places. It led to mass death, right? Millions of people are dying. In China, they crushed it. They sealed the borders. They pursued zero COVID, and in the process, they saved hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of lives, which is wonderful, right? And but they made a big deal out of this politically, right? And so they said this demonstrates the superiority of the Chinese system against all the other systems in the world. But really, they're just talking about the United States, right? And so authoritarianism is better than democracy responding to this. Of course, they're ignoring the successes of places like Taiwan, especially Japan, Australia, New Zealand, these countries that have also done very, very well in democratic systems. But in any event, they made a big deal out of it. Xi Jinping took personal ownership of it and said, we're going to stick with this to demonstrate our superiority. Now, time is going by. We get to 2022. You know, the rest of the world has been through this mass death and all these other problems that you were just alluding to. But, you know, we come out of it and I mean, we're not out of it, but you know, the very intense period is behind us. And China, in the meantime, has stuck with the zero COVID and had this kind of hubris that they'd be able to continue to do it indefinitely. And so they have not, in the meantime, gone about making the accommodations to eventually exit. And they have to exit because it is endemic, right? If they want to be part of the world at this point, they have no choice. So they have not done an adequate job vaccinating the population. If you look at the vaccination rates among seniors, it's quite bad, right? They have not approved mRNA vaccines that were produced in Europe and the United States, you know, basically out of national pride. And so they're using domestic vaccines, the old kind of technology that is much less effective. And there's suggestions that it's almost ineffective, at least at preventing infection against Omicron, may still be somewhat more effective against hospitalization and deaths. And their ICU capacity, their respirator capacity is quite bad, actually, and it's particularly bad in outside of the big cities. So given that backdrop, if today they were just going to say, we're going to let it rip, kind of America style, there'd be millions of people dead. And so I think that it is complicated, right? The zero COVID has a justification of saving lives. They can't do it forever, right? And so now the question, part of the reason why people are so mad is they have not been making these preparations for the fact that the virus is one day going to spread in China. And so they're in a really tough position right now.
And there hasn't been, is there also sort of like an issue of the supposed informed consent type of thing, like where, you know, a significant portion of this country was like, yeah, we're okay with this amount of math tests. I mean, it's a little disturbing. I would say it's very disturbing, but there has been a significant portion of this country is just like, we're just okay with this mass death. And, you know, I don't want to have to wear a mask when I go to the supermarket. And so that's that. They haven't been through that process yet, right? Where there's an opportunity for people to sort of witness and then accept, I guess, or not the mass death. And so they're still sort of like, it's almost like they're going to have to go through their sort of COVID adolescence at a later date. Is that sort of the situation?
Yeah, although part of the issue is that they are keenly aware of the mass death because that has been a key propaganda talking point for the government. Remember, the whole point is the Chinese system is superior. Look at all these dead bodies piling up in New York City and in London and wherever else. So they really know about that. There's also been a lot of discussion in official media, which is, of course, all state controlled, about how dangerous the virus is and remains. They're trying to walk some of that back now as they are walking away from zero COVID. But people in China, I would say, on average, are much more concerned about the virus than people are in the United States. You don't have that same kind of polarization. Like wearing a mask in China is just like not an issue. Everyone does that. But they're very worried about it. So, you know, you have these protests, which I support, and I think ending the zero COVID policy, at least as it's been implemented, it's been very destructive. I think that's a good thing. But you do need to have this pathway out, and inevitably it's going to generate opposition from people who are concerned about those health effects, right? And, you know, we'll see if zero COVID gets ended in kind of a haphazard way without the proper development of health infrastructure, then it could be extremely destructive. And that in and itself could also generate other kinds of political problems for the state.
Has this sort of like this pushback against the zero COVID policy, has that also sort of calmed things in terms of Taiwan? Because it feels like we were on the precipice of something, and now it feels like we're not quite, or am I just kidding myself and we still are?
No, I think you're right. I'm actually going to Taiwan on Saturday. So pleased to see that things are going to be a little bit calmer. You know, we're definitely not out of the woods with respect to Taiwan. And that's another whole issue. I mean, the Chinese government reserves the right to use force, and they frequently talk about how they will use force to annex Taiwan, if and when they want to. The immediate crisis over Nancy Pelosi's visit has passed. You know, China had, in my view, a pretty over-the-top militaristic kind of a response to that. But even before the zero COVID thing happened, that had kind of calmed down a little bit. Now, this does provide another kind of distraction. Xi Jinping is spending his time now thinking about how to exit zero COVID rather than what to do about Taiwan. But the problem is fundamentally still there. I mean, there's no diplomatic resolution to that problem remotely in sight.
Was there anything that aside from Pelosi's visit that created that rose tensions? Like I don't understand like why tensions would be less or more in any given point, because this has been going on for decades.
You know, it's against the backdrop of worsening U.S.-China relations, right? So particularly from the Trump administration on, we've seen heightened hostility in a variety of spheres, right? Most famously, I think on trade under Trump. Biden has more or less continued those. I mean, he's less unhinged and less racist, certainly in his rhetoric about China. But there is pretty much bipartisan consensus in D.C. right now around getting tough on China. And Biden, in some ways, has been more, I mean, he's definitely been more effective at corralling allies into confronting China, right? So we see the AUKUS pact between the United States, UK, and Australia. We see a reinvigorated Quad, which is the India, Australia, Japan, and the United States coordinating military activities. So all of these things are happening in a context where China feels, both China and the United States feel threatened. I mean, the United States has legitimate, you know, critiques of China as well. And so I, against that backdrop, the Taiwan issue has also just become more serious.
The other day, Biden was in a Phoenix plant, a semiconductor plant, that was sort of notably owned by mainland Chinese interests as opposed to Taiwanese interests.
No. TSMC is Taiwanese owned.
Oh, okay. I had that backwards. All right. That makes more sense, because I was wondering, like, why would he do that? Now I get it. All right.
He's very clearly, the Commerce Department is very clearly trying to kneecap the development of China's semiconductors.
Okay. Yes. I was confused by that, and I appreciate that. All right. One more question. You mentioned that the fire in Urumqi, I guess.
Urumqi.
The deaths of 10 Uyghurs there. Where are we in terms of our understanding of what the Chinese policy has been towards the Uyghurs and what they have done? I mean, we've, over the past couple of years, I feel like we've had competing reports as to Uyghurs are being sent to internment camps, Uyghurs are being sent to death camps. What is your best understanding of what has happened in regard to the Uyghurs?
So there's definitely a lot of information that we do not have, and we have to piece it together from various sources. There is little doubt that hundreds of thousands, if not more than a million Uyghurs, have been sent to non-voluntary camps. Some people call them concentration camps. The Chinese government refers to them as re-education centers, but it is a non-voluntary form of at least temporary incarceration that does not go through any kind of legal procedure. So that really took off in 2017, and there's overwhelming evidence from satellites, from the Chinese government's own statements that demonstrate that this has happened. It's become a little bit more complicated since then. There's some evidence that many of those have been shut down. I should say that there is no evidence that there are death camps. People have definitely died while in custody because they've been beaten to death or they had some health issue that was not treated. But when, you know, you say concentration camps, people just think of the Holocaust, and there's no evidence that it is eliminationist. It is assimilationist, though. So they are forcing people to learn Mandarin. They are giving them some kind of job training and oftentimes dispatching them to these forced labor arrangements to private companies, some of which are integrated into the global supply chains of American and European corporations. And there's also been evidence that they are shifting more from these internment camps to mass incarceration. So actually going through some sort of legal procedure where they are charging people with separatism or something like that, and then giving them long jail sentences. And so you can actually look at the Chinese government's own data. The number of people incarcerated on long-term jail sentences of over 5 years has gone up really dramatically in the last few years. So there's no question that hundreds of thousands of people are still missing, and really the only crime that they committed was being Uyghur or being Muslim.
Interesting. Eli Friedman, professor at Cornell University School of Industrial Labor Relations, author of The China Question, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. Really helpful.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure. Thanks very much.
All right, folks. That signals the end of the free half of the program, wherein we will go into the fun half.
Yes.
I'm now careful to make sure that the guest is clear before I say that. I'll probably get over that little hiccup.
Better half.
We're not going to say that
now. Certainly not.
No. Folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only help the show survive and thrive, but you also get the free show free of commercials. And then you get the fun half.
Hmm.
And then you get things like, you can IM the show via the app at majorityapp.com. Also, don't forget, send us your best of suggestions. You got a couple more days, and that's about it. Maybe a couple more. Send us at majorityreporters@gmail.com, majorityreporters@gmail.com. Also, today is, of course, Pearl Harbor Day, which I also know as my sister's birthday. And so that is the day that...
lives in infamy.
It lives in infamy in our household when my youngest sister was born. So happy birthday, Betsy.
I feel like I see more on the timeline about Fred Hampton being assassinated by the police on December 4th than I do about Pearl Harbor Day on December 7th. And I just think it's interesting. Like, that feels different than, like, 10 years ago, for instance.
Yeah.
Like, people don't really talk about the Pearl Harbor stuff as much as they used to.
No. I think part of it is that 9/11 supplanted it in the sort of the popular consciousness. And I also think that, frankly, you know, you get to a certain point and people who were alive and sort of an age where they would remember it now. I mean, we're talking 80 years ago. If you were born in 1940 or, you know, 82 years ago, if you're born,
were like eight.
Right. I mean, and so, you know, there's not that many people who are alive to talk about it. And there's not that many, you know, and I think that's what happens with, events like that. You know, Pearl Harbor no longer was the sort of central primary story of America being attacked. 9/11 supplanted that. And my sister's birthday also.
supplanted that.
But Larry Bird also born today.
Hmm.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which... is also I'm pretty excited about.
Us December birthdays.
There you go.
Not a hoop.
Also, don't forget.
And Larry Bird.
Me and Larry.
JustCoffee.co-op, fair trade coffee,
George
tea, or chalk. JustCoffee.co-op, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Emma! What's happening on ESPN? Sorry to hear about Aaron Judge.
Yeah, well,
signing with the Yankees again. Can't tell you how excited I would have been if he had left.
I mean, there's some Mets fans in my life like joking that Steve Cohen will throw the bag at him. He'll come over to Citi Field, and that's not what ended up happening, obviously. But it was funny while it lasted. On Monday, we spoke a bit about the Deion Sanders departure from Jackson State, the controversy, how the whole college system is like set up for exploitation, and what the controversy about him leaving says about it. We talked a bit about DeGrom leaving New York as well, plus just generally the major storylines happening in the NFL tomorrow. Bradley and I will be giving our picks against the spread this weekend. I am the tortoise. Crawling back from the ashen, from the ashes. I'm mixing a lot of metaphors here.
Strange metaphor.
You know, tortoises live in like water.
The tortoise is in the phoenix's ashes.
I'm mixing a lot of animals here.
I think you're like the dragon.
Yeah.
Like the slow dragon coming from the ashes.
A dragon, you know how in like some non-Western cultures, dragons don't have wings and they're more just like crawling but breathing fire. So I'm that kind of dragon. Okay. And I'm coming back. I have tied Bradley in wins at this point. The pushes are still keeping him alive. So it's getting down to the wire.
I can to lose this, honestly.
Yeah, Bradley's gone 0-6 the weeks before, and then he went 1-2 this last week. So we'll check out that hot competition, youtube.com/ESPN show.
Oh, Chomsky's birthday? No, yeah. Chomsky's birthday is today too?
Yep,
I did not
7th,
know that.
1928, I just saw that.
I got to say, all that, I love my sister more than
Noam Chomsky.
If there was
Noam Chomsky
like
and Larry Bird, yeah. Although, I mean,
that's tough.
I'm not going to lie, it's tight. Yeah. It's not.
Your sister has some competition on
Yeah, that's tough. Yeah.
And Noam Chomsky can join Matt's basketball team.
My early December birthday's basketball team with me, Larry Bird, and George Armstrong Custer.
What's happening in the Matt Leck Media Enterprise?
Yeah, we zone. Matt Leck Media Enterprise Zone. We had Kurt Hackbarth on to talk about AMLO and the way the New York Times reports about him, and also Benjamin Case to talk about why socialists should take a ballot initiative seriously and what can be accomplished engaging in that part of politics. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get access to our postgame.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920 is the number. We will see you in the fun half, wherein we will discuss both Warnock's win and other sundry things.
Like your cruise trip.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'll talk about that. Oh, it's a lot of terror.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy. Okay.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy is back, and the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back. Back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank, okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on!
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am in total
pussy.